Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight at long last, after a lengthy absence, to discuss the 1983 remake of Scarface, directed by Brian De Palma. Please say hello to my little friend, Alex Lawson.
Give me one second, just gotta do a quick bump. Oh, okay.
No, yes, bumps.
Thanks for having me. Thank
you. Put your face down in a pile of cocaine.
I know, but that doesn't play over the audio, so I'm trying to...
but
I'm
the bump to, totally really, worked.
Really, really, yeah, didn't it? Everybody's like just feels like they're at a Coke party now.
So, hey, yeah. By the way, sorry, ladies. He's engaged. Congratulations.
Which one of you butts said we were engaged? Yes, that's
same
true.
Same one that said you had class.
Oh, I've never understood that line,
it's
by the way.
It's not the best sick burn coming from Shades Guy Patterson, but listen, whatever. He goes right off to make it with Faye. Congratulations to you, sir.
Thanks. Yeah, I got engaged on Valentine's Day because I am the hippest, coolest, most original guy in the entire city of New York. But yeah,
right on top of the Empire State Building or what?
Oh, no. Oh, my God. I mean, that would have, I really would have gotten slapped across the face. I think my fiance is very much of the sort of insular sort of professions of our love and all that. But yeah, just a nice little modest proposal here in the living room and all that, and it all went fine.
So
yeah, it's great.
Suggested
thank you for
eating
yeah.
orphans. Is that? I hear modest proposal and I go right to I go right to eating orphans.
Oh my God.
So we've done we've done cocaine references, we've done That Thing You Do, and now Jonathan Swift. So you're listening
That's
to
right.
F This Movie, everyone. You can find
you
our
know
website.
What you came for.
You can find our website at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Twitter. We are at fthismovie. Like our page on Facebook if you haven't already. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us in the iTunes store. If you like us, review us, say something nice. We love it. Helps the show. Helps you, helps everyone. Tonight's show actually comes via reader/listener request. Somebody going by the handle Booster Gold asked that we do a podcast on Scarface. And I thought, sure, we've never done a podcast on a De Palma movie. Let's do one on one of my least favorite De Palma movies. So we are going to be talking about Scarface in just a little bit. Now, Alex, you've been away from the show for some time, so we have some catching up to do. In the last roughly year, have you seen anything good?
I mean, I've seen a lot of good things. I want to jump to what I've seen a little more recently. Just
that makes
because
sense.
A lot,
no, that makes sense.
A lot of the stuff that I liked has been discussed pretty exhaustively in my absence. So I'll just
it doesn't make sense to go back a full year. I know.
I
wasn't thinking, and I'm sorry. Listen, I'm sorry to you. I'm sorry to the listeners of F This Movie. I'm sorry, you guys. I'm sorry.
Totally fine. A couple of weeks ago, I saw Still Alice.
Mm-hmm.
Which have
and,
you seen that
and
yet?
You've already forgotten it. What?
Oh, damn. Have you seen it yet? I know it's like still like filtering out into the viewership pool or whatever. But
yeah,
have you seen it?
Yeah, I saw it.
The further and further away I get from it, the more I really dislike it. When I, as soon as the lights came up, I thought it was sort of an okay movie with a really dynamite performance at the center of it. And now as I think back on it, it's not a very good movie. And I don't think that great of a performance. I'm not trying to, you know me, I don't try and play contrarian dickhead just for the sake of it.
You don't try.
But it just, I don't try. Perhaps I'm backing into it this way. But it's the movie that just is like coasting on a lot of manipulative, like,
I don't know if it's manipulative. I mean, unfortunately, anytime you do kind of a disease movie, they tend to all feel very similar. And so it is manipulation. That doesn't take away from the fact that obviously it's very sad. The reality of that disease is sad. So the movie has that going for it. But I mean, I agree. I thought the acting was pretty good. Julianne Moore clearly was being awarded an Oscar for being Julianne Moore and just always being good in every movie that she's in and in a field without another clear standout. But to me, it was kind of like a little bit of a glorified TV movie.
That's how I, yeah, that's probably a good way to put it. You're welcome. When I said it was like sort of being manipulative, I mean, it's so easy to generate, you know, drama or a powerful emotional feeling out of something that is so objectively sad. And so it sort of just didn't feel like some great achievement to like make me, it's like, okay, so I'm sitting here and I'm sad, but I mean, it's sort of, it's like a tautology or something.
I thought there were a couple of scenes that stand out to me as being strong. I mean, I thought there was a scene where she gets lost in her own house and has like a bathroom accident that I thought was genuinely sad. There's a scene where she's out to ice cream with Alec Baldwin later in the film, and he asks her a very pointed question, and I thought that was really moving. So there are things that stood out, but I thought the movie was just okay.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about this before, either on a podcast I was on or one I was listening to, but you've definitely made this remark about, it's been said so many times, but I continue to not really be able to take Alec Baldwin very seriously in movies like this. he's just permanently Jack Donaghy. I mean, I know this is not like a novel observation or anything, but like I kept waiting for him to like turn to the camera and say some goofy shit,
which is crazy because prior to 30 Rock, he was basically known as a dramatic actor. Yet Jack Donaghy is such a sort of iconic character and or performance that it has kind of colored the rest of his career.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like actively detracting from my experience of watching these movies. Significant way, but definitely not something that I can just shake off anymore, and I don't anticipate it anytime soon. What else? So that was Still Alice. That is the fulsome, exhaustive analysis of Still Alice.
Yeah, I think we really covered the whole thing.
I also sought out a documentary that was from 2013, but it had slipped by my radar, and it was the Michel Gondry documentary called Is the Man Who Is Tall Happy? Did you see that movie?
No.
It's this great, I thought it was pretty great. It's just like a 90-minute documentary, and it's Michel Gondry sitting down and having a conversation with Noam Chomsky, and they talk about a variety. They talk about language, because he's a linguist, of course, and you know, the rise of intellectual thought and the way we evolve as a culture and all the types of all the Noam Chomsky hallmarks, without dipping into like too much of the political stuff. But the thing that makes it great, even though it's just these two guys basically having this intellectual conversation, is that it's accompanied by this great animation that sort of, if you're the type of person who would roll your eyes at this sort of like overly academic exercise of like verbal masturbation or something, it really like it literally illustrates the concepts that they're talking about in a really interesting way. It's like got this very stripped down basic 2D animation sketches come to life kind of thing. It's on Netflix now. It has a like unbearably stupid title that makes sense when you watch the movie, but it's called Is the Man Who Is Tall Happy? And if that sounds interesting to you, I would seek it out.
I haven't seen it. I have two quick thoughts. One, the movie clearly should have been called Noam Chomsky's Block Party. Two, I am a little bit burned out. And again, I haven't seen the movie, so I'm not criticizing this movie or your characterization of it. It's something that I have noticed independent of this, but you made me think of it right now. So you really like the animation. You're saying it works for the movie. It explains certain concepts. That is great. I'm not attacking that. But I have noticed that so many documentaries now like can't just be a documentary. They all have to have wacky animation or clips from other movies interspersed, or I know it goes back further than Bowling for Columbine, but Bowling for Columbine was kind of one of the first documentaries to really break through into the mainstream, and some of the things that Michael Moore does in that movie, now everybody sees that and says, well, documentaries can't just be heads talking, we gotta do all this fancy shit, and so they add all this stuff in, and sometimes I feel like it's very much to the detriment of the movie. I remember seeing Evocateur, the Morton Downey Jr. movie, or I don't remember the exact title. It's the documentary on Morton Downey Jr. And there's so much of that nonsense. Like, you probably could have just played this story out with clips from the show, interviews, archival photographs, whatever. But like all the time, we got to cut to this new animation that's supposed to, reflect the emotional states going on. Like, just have people talk. You're a documentary. It's okay. Again,
yeah, there's always.
I haven't seen Noam Chomsky's Block Party, so I don't know for sure. that it would bother me in that movie, but it's something that I've seen. I don't remember what it was. I recently just watched a documentary, and they were doing the exact same thing. I don't remember what it was, but I just noticed it in another film recently.
This is not exactly the thing you're talking about, but I'm curious to know of it now that you're sort of marking this. Did you have a strong opinion on the reenactments in Man on Wire?
You know, I haven't seen Man on Wire.
I
don't know.
You are the documentary guy. Like, you are the maven consuming all this stuff.
Yeah. No, I'm really not. Erica loves
Well, you watch more than I do, so.
Yeah, maybe. Erica really loves documentaries. I mean, I like them. Cool. I'm not anti-documentary, but I cannot accept that title because there are people who have seen way more than me, so.
Okay. I definitely noticed, like, the trend that you're talking about where people sort of feel the need to, if you're one thing for too long, you want to take a left turn and like do the documentary,
It's this need to like make the documentary hipper and more palatable to modern audiences. Which, I mean, if more people are seeing documentaries, great. But I just feel like it's pandering a little bit.
In this particular instance, I would definitely encourage you to seek it out. Again, it's barely 90 minutes long. If you don't like it, it won't take up too much of your time. I think it services the concepts that they're talking about in an interesting way, mostly because Michel Gondry is, in many instances, a very visual storyteller. And without this, it's like two guys literally sitting. They're literally just sitting at a table and talking.
Right.
There is no other thing, and that would be cool. Some people I've seen somewhere that it's basically just like, some people think it's like basically like a glorified PowerPoint presentation, I guess, which is not something I can really rebut in an X's and O's kind of way, but if that's what it is, it's a very interesting PowerPoint presentation to me. But check it out.
Right on. Anything else?
I mean, again, lots else, but I don't want to ramble on too much. We got a lot to dive into here. Why don't you go?
Before I go into what I have seen lately, I want to do a real quick plug for anyone in or around the Chicago area. On Tuesday, March 10th, I will be hosting screenings of Blazing Saddles through the Chicago Film Critics Association at the Elk Grove Cinema in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. It's actually through a weird bit of convenience or fate or luck or whatever. It is the theater that I grew up. I reference it all the time when I write. I talk about, there was this theater down the street from my house. I used to walk there every weekend. I saw every movie there because it was $1.50, and I would just go see whatever I could. This is that theater. It's been remodeled since I used to go there, so it's actually a different structure, but it's in the location. It's where I used to go. So, along with the Chicago Film Critics Association, I'll be hosting a screening of Blazing Saddles and doing a Q&A following the film. There are screenings at 1 o'clock and 7 o'clock. If you are near that area, you should definitely come out and say hi. Back to what I have seen lately. Here's the deal. We are talking about Julianne Moore. So, I watched David Cronenberg's latest movie, Maps to the Stars, and I don't know, 1,000 to 1,500 words on it. I was going to publish a review, and then I came back the following morning and the review had been lost, and I thought,
so you're just punting on this now. We exchange emails on this. I thought you were gonna try and resurrect.
I had debated, like, do I try to remember what I wrote and write the thing again, but I felt so defeated that I knew
that's a pain. Yeah,
it was like, I knew, and I already didn't love the movie, but I knew I would be even less fair to it because now I was blaming the movie for losing my review. So I was like, I should probably not. So I'll just talk about it on the show. You haven't seen it yet, right?
I have not. I as I said to you in our brief email exchange, I was really looking forward to it. But you said, in your opinion, not so awesome.
I mean, listen, I think people should check it out, especially if you're a fan of David Cronenberg. I have liked this current phase in his career a little bit less than I have liked his phases in, let's say, the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
this is a mess. Like, I just, there's no other way to put it. It's a mess. It's a mess with things to like. Julianne Moore, once again, gives a fascinating and very good performance and is asked to say and do some things that I just can't conceive another actress doing as well as she does. The movie doesn't quite know what it wants to be, doesn't quite know what it wants to say. It's weirdly kind of sloppily made, I feel like, which is unusual for a David Cronenberg movie.
Definitely.
He's like a pretty controlled guy in terms of his technique. And I felt like this was sloppy. And one of the problems, and this was in the review before it was lost forever, is that he's working from
this
a
script. This is great. This is like your B-sides or something. This is really interesting.
He's working from a script that is very talkative. It's okay. Like, bah, 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 and it's a lot of just scenes of two characters bouncing off one another very quickly. And I don't feel like Cronenberg moves at that pace. Like, I don't think I don't think his life moves at that pace. I mean, he's a super smart, cerebral guy. And I'm sure he has the ability to be chatty, but his movies don't have that rhythm. And so to watch this movie, the rhythm of the dialogue is actually moving a little bit too fast, and you can almost feel Cronenberg trying to catch up, but he can't. And it doesn't work. It doesn't help that I don't think the dialogue is particularly good either, but there was a disconnect between what was written on the page and what he was trying to do kind of stylistically. There's one special effects shot, and I won't spoil what it is, but it involves some fire. That is one of the worst special effects shot. I think I tweeted out that if more people were seeing this movie, the CGI fire in Maps to the Stars would be the new American Sniper fake baby, because it's just as horrible. And you watch something like that and you think, hey, if you couldn't pull that off practically or more convincingly via computers, you gotta come up with something else. Like, either make that, because it's actually it's a really important moment. It's a scene in which probably three different threads kind of come together, and it has to be fire. They couldn't have changed it. It literally has to be fire based on the story. So you either have to make that work or change your entire script. I don't know. It's so distracting at a moment that really needs to land. And to me, that kind of summarizes the whole movie. It's like, oh, this should have worked, but there's three things working against it that make it fall short.
And it's not like, again, I haven't seen it. We're talking in like a cryptic way about something that I'm just kind of trying to get after a little bit, but it's not in like a cryptic or a cryptic, that's what I just said. It's not in like a campy, like, intentional way or anything like that. I mean, this is
special,
just like
the badness of the special effect.
Correct. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
No, not at all.
I trust you.
I think an argument can be made that some of the movie is pitched at that level. I'm not
sort of the vibe that I was picking up. That's why I asked.
And I'm not even 100% convinced of that. There's a lot of people who are saying, oh, yeah, it's this hilarious comedy. And some of that may be true. It may be intended to be comedy. I take issue with hilarious. But okay. But again, I think the movie is not quite sure what it wants to say. And I kind of read it as I don't know, kind of a satire on Hollywood. I mean, I don't think it's being too subtle about that. But then I read an interview with Cronenberg where he says, no, it's not a satire, because the screenwriter has heard all of these things actually said. So how can something be a satire if it's real?
It's real.
Right. The movie didn't work for me. And that's disappointing, obviously, because I'm a big Cronenberg fan. I saw a movie called Wormwood, Road of the Dead, which is a new Australian zombie movie that, again, I wanted to like a lot more, very much influenced by Sam Raimi and Peter Jackson and George Miller. It's kind of the zombie movie by way of The Road Warrior. I think the director shows some talent. I think it introduces a few new ideas in the very much overplayed zombie genre at this point. We need to take a break from zombies for a while.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, between The Walking Dead and the proliferation of like all the other sort of like sub genres.
Yeah, I mean every third
zombie offshoots.
Right.
Yeah, I don't.
Every third independent horror movie that comes out right now is a zombie movie, and you know, you can do them fairly cheaply and you can work some gore in there, and they're very, very popular thanks to The Walking Dead. If you go on Netflix Instant right now and just type in the word zombie, I bet you get 25 movies, and three of them will be worth watching. So this wasn't horrible. I mean, I didn't feel like I'd wasted my time, but the independent horror scene has gotten so good, and particularly some of the movies I've seen recently out of like Australia and New Zealand, that I probably had my hopes unreasonably high for something really great. And it wasn't quite, but that's okay. I watched a movie called They're Playing with Fire, which came out in 1984. I don't think is even available on DVD. If it is, it's long out of print. So I listen to this podcast, Killer POV. I talk about it all the time.
And yeah, yeah.
It came up on that show, and I thought, well, I have to see that movie. So Sybil Danning, which is the main reason that I watched it, plays a high school teacher who kind of seduces her student into scaring somebody for her. She wants to inherit some money. I don't even want to say where the movie goes, because and I think even on Killer POV they kind of characterize it as like it starts out as a sex comedy like My Tutor or something. These were very popular in the early 80s, the hot teacher seducing the student, and by the end it's like a full-blown slasher movie. So it goes crazy places. I can only recommend it to people who like that, these kinds of movies, or fans of Sybil Danning, because it has some of the best Sybil Danning you're ever going to see. And I say this as somebody who's not even, I mean, I hate The Howling too. I do not think that movie's good at all. And yet the moment where Sybil Danning rips open her shirt in that movie, I'm not even trying to be funny when I say that's one of the best things ever put on film. So this movie has that times a lot. So that is worth checking out if you're a crazy person like I am. I watched it on YouTube.
You were just about to say you watched it on YouTube. Okay.
I did. So
I was going to ask how you tracked it down. You said it wasn't in print or anything.
Okay. No, and I don't have a VCR hooked up, so there's a lot of these movies that like I want to see that are only available on VHS, and a lot of times those copies go for a lot on Amazon or eBay. I don't like to watch movies on YouTube, but that is how I saw it. I kind of took a shot and was like, hey, I wonder if this is on here, and sure enough, it was. So I watched that. And the last movie I'll talk about is another horror film that I saw. This one's from, I think, 2012, and it's called Found. And it is not a found footage movie, thank goodness.
Speaking of trends that can take a seat for a while.
Holy shit, never again. It's written and directed by a guy named Scott Shermer. It's based on a novel. It's about a kid who kind of finds out that his brother is a serial killer. It opens with the kid basically saying, like, I found a severed head in my brother's bedroom. And the kid is obsessed with horror movies, and so there's all kinds of, like, old, cool cult horror movie posters on his wall, and he asks his brother, you know, can I watch your copy of Hellraiser again? So as a horror fan growing up, I saw a lot of myself in the kid. I had an older brother. My older brother killed a lot of people as well. So I felt like it was very sort of autobiographical for me. There was a lot of the movie that I really liked. I thought it was actually a really kind of well-done independent horror film. And then about halfway through, the kid rents a movie called Headless, which is this, you know, fake horror movie that they made up for the purposes of this movie, and puts it in. And so we get to see some scenes from this fake horror movie, Headless. And those scenes are so repellent and so gory and so graphic and so kind of out of step with what I think is in the rest of the movie, that it kind of lost me, and it never quite got me back. I mean, I think the movie does get back on track. I think it earns where it goes by the end. But I think the decision to show that stuff is such a miscalculation that I think it throws the whole movie out of balance, which is unfortunate because I think the movie actually, you know, didn't need any of that stuff. We didn't have to actually watch the movie that he's watching, you know.
Does this represent a good chunk of the running time?
No, it's maybe 10 minutes in the middle of the movie. And it's there. It's there because the kid is sort of, you know, it's this movie about a serial killer that he's watching. And so he starts picturing his brother as this killer. And so I understand its thematic positioning, but I think you probably could have still made that point without going as crazy far as, I mean, I don't even want to describe what's shown, but it's nuts. And that alone is going to send some people to see it and is going to keep some people away. Disturbingly, so then I wrote something, I think, on Twitter about it, and Brian Smith, who's a horror fan that I'm just friends with on Twitter, I think he's out of New York, wrote me back and said, oh, yeah, they're making Headless, that fake movie, into its own movie now as like a spinoff. And I looked on IMDb, and sure enough, there it is, 2015, Headless. So I will never see Headless.
You've seen enough.
But I can recommend most of Found. I think there's a lot to like in it. I think if you just fast forward maybe through those 10 minutes in the middle, your life will be just a little bit better.
All right.
And that's it for me.
You spray to all fields at the upfronts every time.
I cannot believe you're still saying upfronts.
The upfronts. Just one of these times, I'm gonna go. I'm like, maybe I'll have heard of one of these things once, but it's great. You always come with like all these fresh, great ideas. Those sound cool.
Some of them are cool. Some of them are cool.
Some of them, right? Not as awesome. Yeah.
Horrible gore, Sybil Danning's boobs, and a Cronenberg misfire. You're welcome, everyone.
Seek them out.
So you want to talk about Scarface?
I feel like we don't have any choice. I'm going to try. I'm trying really hard to refrain from doing any Tony Montana impersonations. And well, so far, so good.
I'm proud of you.
Thanks.
Where to start framing this conversation? Because Scarface is so much more than a movie now. You know? It is a cultural landmark, a film that has been embraced by so many, most for the wrong reasons. People have giant posters of it hanging on their wall. Anytime you watch Cribs on MTV, this is the movie they have on.
You're stealing my thunder here. This is,
So I am a huge Brian De Palma fan, right? I love Brian De Palma. And I know that he's not for everyone. And I opened the show by saying this was one of my least favorite Brian De Palma movies. And I'm not 100% sure that's true, because I think he has a few movies that are kind of actively bad. And I wouldn't put Scarface in that category. I think it's a very watchable movie, if incredibly bloated and overlong, but I can watch it pretty easily. Having said that, I don't think it's a particularly good movie, and yet there's all these things that I can point to that I'd be like, yeah, but I like this about it. Oh, and I like this about it, and this, you know. I don't like the kind of disco holdover production design, music, styling. It's just not to my taste, right? Doesn't make it a bad movie. It's just not for me. And yet, it's like there's something comforting about when I see it in the context of Scarface, because I'm like, oh, I'm watching Scarface.
It begins to transcend a lot of the like sort of critical touchstones that you think about when you like try and dissect this stuff.
Yeah, I remember we did a show on Heat years ago.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking of, actually. Yeah.
And there were all these things, and I'm like, yeah, this probably isn't that good, and this maybe doesn't work, but you know, that's what makes it Heat. And I think the same can be said of Scarface, which is not criticism, you know, just saying like, this thing that's in Scarface, that's what makes it Scarface. That's not conversation. I will say this. My biggest, maybe not my biggest frustration, one of my biggest frustrations as a Brian De Palma fan in watching Scarface is that I feel like there's so little of him in it. This comes off of, you know, he was making a series of thrillers, all of which I love. You know, most people have labeled him just a Hitchcock ripoff. But he had made Blowout prior to this. He had made Dressed to Kill prior to this. And in the 70s, he was making Sisters and Carrie and Phantom of the Paradise and all these great movies. And so this is a different kind of a movie for him. I don't want to say this is him stepping up to the majors, but in some ways it is. And watching it this most recent time, I just watched it again this weekend for the purposes of this podcast, there were these moments that I could point to and say, okay, there's De Palma. Okay, there's De Palma. And it's all the craziest shit in the movie. It's,
yeah,
it's the scene in the beginning with the chainsaws. It's all the stuff, all the incest stuff with him and his sister. It's kind of the shootout at the end. It's like, you can tell the parts that really interest him because he comes to life and the movie comes to life in a way that it doesn't for the rest of it. And watching it, I always feel like it's comparable to like Bonfire of the Vanities, which is a movie that gets shit on so much by everyone, not just De Palma fans. But I feel like this is almost as much and as little a Brian De Palma movie as Bonfire of the Vanities is.
Yeah, I'm not the De Palma junkie that you are. So I don't, like, I wasn't really sort of viewing it through that. But it sounds like we're kind of on the same page here, just in terms of, okay, just to tell you where, like, I came at it from. I have not seen this movie front to back since
your days as a gangster
high school, basically. No, it was over 10 years. And I never really had any strong opinions about it in the intervening time. I just remember watching it. Now I've seen Scarface, because I was a person who watched a lot of MTV Cribs. And I was like, well, now I've seen that thing that people always talk about. And then it was sort of gone from my mind for much of the last, more than a decade. And then when it was done this time, I didn't find myself exclaiming, whoa, man, did I miss that? It was weird for me to hear you say, to describe it as watchable, just because it just, like, to your, like you said, I mean, it's so bloated, and it feels like such a failure of the craft of editing. It's easy to just say, oh, the movie's too long, the editors suck. But I mean, in this movie, it really shows. But then after I meditated on it for a while, I mean, I found myself sort of like talking in circles about what works and what doesn't, and I realized like it flirts with so many interesting ideas that don't really jibe together in any organic way, but are intriguing enough to just kind of hang on the wall as part of this massive, like, borderline pornographic, violent thing that we know as Scarface. Like you're talking about, it just like makes it Scarface.
But yeah, the
I thought.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
When he's being interrogated by the cops, and he gives a very sort of passionate speech about the dangers of communism, and about how people are telling you what to think and what to feel and how to act. And then I had forgotten or didn't know that the film had like this like gravitas about it that like spoke to the evils of communism. And then it just kind of dies on the vine and goes nowhere, except that he swings to like the complete opposite extreme of like violent capitalism. And that's just one of many examples that sort of you flirt with this interesting theme, and then it just kind of gets sucked up into this whole other thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way of putting it, that the movie often like flirts with being something so much more interesting, because unfortunately it is like super straightforward, right? And even all of the communism stuff, all the Cuban stuff, to me feels like Oliver Stone, who wrote the screenplay for the film, trying to, put his usual political self-importance all over a film that probably didn't need it. I mean, you know, I understand that, like, they want to make him sort of an outsider in the interest of having him achieve the American dream, right? That we can't just have an American-born citizen look at the American dream and say, I want that, and then achieve it to such a crazy degree, you know, that it ends up destroying him and blah, 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 that it ends up being, you know, a critique of the American dream. So they make this choice to make him an outsider. Watching it this time, and maybe I haven't thought this all the way through, so I apologize, but you know, that's what this podcast is for.
That's what it's about. That's what we're here for, yeah.
I thought it was just odd that it opens with this narration about all these Cubans left Cuba and they came to the United States. And then the rest of the movie portrays Cubans as murderous psychopaths. And it's like, so is this whole movie just meant to make us afraid of Cubans? I don't know. I would not be thrilled about that if I was somebody from Cuba at that time or ever. Because I just feel like that is an unnecessary... in a necessary storytelling device? I don't know. And maybe I'm just reacting to the fact that I cannot for the life of me understand why you would make a film about a lot of Cubans and then cast a single Cuban actor. Just the one.
I was gonna get to that later, but we can do it now.
We'll end up jumping around all over the place. Stephen Bauer gives the best performance in the film.
100% agree. Yeah.
But that's not only because he's the only Cuban, right? It can't be. Or is it? Is it that we're able to... Because I can't get past anyone else's crazy accent and brown face makeup. Like, when Robert Loggia is playing a Cuban, all I can think is to have been a more qualified actor who may have been Cuban. F. Murray Abraham, you have got to be kidding me. And, of course, the elephant in the room, Mr. Pacino. And we don't have to jump to Pacino yet. We could talk about how Stephen Bauer is, like, effortlessly really good in this movie and feels natural in a movie filled with performances that are way over the top. Like, way over the top. And that's the only thing that I would say saves the movie's length or speaks to the movie's length. You had said, you know, this movie probably doesn't need to be as long as it is. It's indulgent. It needed an editor. And I guess to the movie's credit, and I'm not even sure that I 100% agree with this, I think the idea is, well, it's a movie about excess, so it's okay to be excessive in its scope and in its telling. And obviously, De Palma set out to truly make an epic. You know, this is like...
Right.
Lawrence of Arabia, if it had way more cocaine and machine guns. So I understand what he was going for. I don't disagree with you. I mean, this is an exhausting, punishing, ugly, depressing movie. Like, there's no fun in it. And that's what I don't quite understand, except for those things that I'm talking about, where De Palma, I can feel him, like, kind of light up behind the camera, and I can tell that he's having fun. But the people that love this movie and have embraced it so much, it's startling to me that they can have fun watching it and rewatch it a bunch of times.
That's where I came down this time, because for as much as it's sort of, like you say, bandied about as this tentpole of culture and excess and violence and all the stuff that we like about these kinds of crime movies, violence and drugs and women and things like that. I mean, it's a lot of it is drags in
because it's one note. It's the same note over and over and over again.
I wanted to. We've started so many threads here that I've been like noting down. I wanted to go. You made the point about sort of painting the Cuban population with a broad brush, and the fact that it sort of has it aspires to be this pseudo political epic with the note that it starts on and him constantly referring to himself as a political refugee and all this other stuff. He tries to give a bite at the apple that you're talking about not painting Cubans that way with those scenes with the mother. Right. But that is just one of many examples of something that is sort of made. There's a piecemeal effort to have this theme, and then it just kind of falls away because you get back to doing God knows what else the movie has on its mind.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I just want to say real quick, I'm okay with the movie saying that this Cuban is a murderous psychopath. You know, I don't feel like Tony Montana is meant to represent all Cubans. I think I only take issue with that opening title card, which suggests America was flooded with Cubans. Mm-hmm. And then zeroing in on Tony Montana as a representative of Cuba. You know what I mean? So I think without that opening title card, I don't think it's sort of as damning a portrait. But that's whatever.
I, Yeah, and we can definitely move on from the stale ass political prong of this movie very shortly. But the card says something about like is 125,000 Cubans, but it was not this act of benevolence that Castro had envisioned it, like letting people go and be with their families. He was like emptying out his jails and his criminals into the United States, and this is the consequence of that action. Whatever the movie is muddled on its politics, like it's muddled on many other things. What did I want to say? The Stephen Bauer performance.
Yes.
You're correct in saying it's the best one in the movie, and I think it's because he has the best character to play. In that it's the only character that I feel approaches an actual human being.
Right.
But then this is what I was saying about in the beginning when I was sort of talking myself in circles, because I tried to think about, all right, like clearly I have all these problems with the movie, like not dealing in any of these themes that it approaches with any nuance or thought. And then I started to think like, who am I demanding nuance and like subtlety or whatever from this movie? I think like, what are the goals that this movie set for itself, and did it achieve them? I think it did. If De Palma and Stone, you know, set out to make this, like you say, this towering epic of violence and excess and the American dream gone wrong, I think they achieve the goals. But I guess then we just get into a conversation are interesting or cool for us to watch, and results are mixed for me.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think Brian De Palma or Oliver Stone would ever be called subtle or nuanced filmmakers. That's not what they do.
Right.
That's not what they're interested in, neither one of them. And you're right. So if the movie achieves its own goals or succeeds on its own terms, then we just have to ask ourselves, like, well, okay, so maybe it's just not for me. You know, like maybe those aren't goals that I'm interested in, like you said, because obviously a lot of people really do like it. And again, I struggle to figure out what it is that they are responding to. And I don't even want to get into like psychoanalyzing all of the people who have held this movie up, hold up Tony Montana as a role model, because that just goes down a path that I'm not particularly interested in. I'd rather just talk about the movie, but it is interesting that he is a hero to some, because I don't think this movie ever, even when I think it's misguided in a lot of ways and the Pacino performance is problematic and there's all these issues that I have with the movie, I do not think that the movie ever once makes him out to be cool, heroic, attractive, appealing, seductive in any way. I mean, at least in New Jack City, like Nino Brown was handing out turkeys to the community, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And Nino Brown obviously is the guy who looks up to Scarface because he learned all the wrong lessons, just as I feel like some of the other people that hold this character up as a role model are taking away all the wrong lessons. But I don't think that's on the movie. I don't think the movie, like, you know how sometimes we can blame movies for, like, well, you weren't clear and you made it seem like this, so people are going to misread it. Like, obviously people are going to take away whatever they want, but I don't think the movie ever suggests anything other than that Tony Montana is a small man, a piece of shit, a psychopath, garbage.
About the I think I agree. About the closest it gets to doing that is one of my is a scene that encapsulates one of my favorite, if I'm calling them sort of aborted themes of the movie that are touched upon briefly and then are dispensed of. It is about the nature of villainy, and it's probably my favorite scene in the movie. It's my favorite non-action set piece in the movie, let's say. And that is, of course, the famous make way for the bad guy scene. I really love it because I like the way. It's a very interesting idea about the notion of him envisioning himself as this foil for the rest of society to make them feel better about themselves and all of their misdeeds that just are probably pretty bad, but just not as bad as him. But like you say, that holds up to no level of scrutiny because he's like an objectively terrible human being and person. And
it's,
so,
and it's just so on the nose, like in a movie.
No, that, I know that.
A movie that is already not subtle at all. I just feel like sometimes Oliver Stone is so afraid that you won't catch his subtext that he just has to have the characters speak it again in a movie that is already very much hitting you over the head. That one hits particularly hard.
Yeah. The first time I ever saw this movie, I will say we were talking earlier about the aesthetic, and about sort of, I think I said campiness, not you, but whatever. I think it's an overrated sort of criticism of movies to say something is dated generally. I think it's a very lazy thing to say. Like, it's just, it's dated. I don't know that we should expect filmmakers to make movies that are meant to be like timeless, like,
no, absolutely not,
pieces of art that reflect every moment in time all the time. That's silly. With that said, this movie like screams 1983 at the top of its lungs without apology, right? And so but I will say that the first time I saw it, I had the two tape VHS set when I saw it in high school. And I will say this is true of basically any movie that's on Blu-ray, but this movie benefited a lot from Blu-ray. I will say when I watched it this time, I was like, oh, this is kind of looking like it was made relatively recently. And that helped. That helped me like broach it a little bit more. That's just saying that they did an okay Blu-ray transfer, I guess. But
I had the exact same response. Because I started out maybe watching this on cable and then VHS and eventually DVD.
Yeah.
And this was my first viewing on Blu-ray. And one of my issues with the movie was always that I thought it was kind of visually uninteresting.
Yeah.
Again, only by Brian De Palma standards. You know, it's not that it's a visually uninteresting movie by all movie standards. But De Palma is such a visual stylist that I was like, it doesn't seem like he doesn't do any of his like crazy moves or his split focus or any of, you know, split screen sequences, any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He's obviously going for kind of a more mainstream down the middle kind of a thing. But so I always thought like the visuals were, there was not much of an emphasis on the visuals with Scarface. And yet watching it on Blu-ray, it's really, I mean, a gorgeously shot movie, even if what it's shooting is like super tacky, you know.
And that's no small feat, like, right?
I mean, no, like that, absolutely not. John Alonzo is the guy I think who shot the movie, I agree 100%. It looked great, and I liked the movie better this time because of it. Exactly like you said.
Yes, yes. Again, we're bouncing all over the place, and I feel like I want to touch on one last story thing before maybe we get into some of the performances.
It's just the one that we have to talk about.
Yeah. I guess I never really gave a lot of thought to the plot of this movie in a big way, because it's just a series of set pieces, you know?
Right.
But one interesting thing is that I noticed this time as I was tracing it in a very deliberate way that Tony Montana's downfall actually arises directly out of the fact that he did something morally good, which is that when he goes to New York to assassinate that crusading journalist who's blowing the whistle on his supplier and all these other drug players, he aborts the mission because the guy's wife and kids get in the car, and he suddenly is so above all of that senseless violence. Plug on the thing and kills the guy, and then he invokes the wrath of Sosa, who sends the guys to his house and kill him. Now, it is the nature of his character that he is doomed to fail and be cause his own demise anyway. But the movie doesn't take pains to point out that it actually arose out of something good, and I'm trying to figure out if that's some good subtle filmmaking or just some kind of crazy haphazard laziness and I'm reading too much into it. Have you ever given that any thought? Cause I hadn't.
Not really. And I do not believe it's accidental, but if it's deliberate, then what is the movie trying to say about
humanity? Yeah, I have no idea.
I mean, it's saying like, hey, if you're a piece of shit and you try to do one good thing, it's going to bite you in the ass and you're going to die.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Which, again, just leads to this movie's incredibly bleak, dark, miserable, angry, hateful worldview. And I'm not saying these as criticisms, just observations. You know, I'm not saying that that's a problem. One of the things that I thought was interesting, I tried to read just a little bit about it after I watched it, not too much because I don't want to be influenced by what other people have said, but one of the things obviously that I read is that the film had to be recut several times. They kept giving De Palma an X rating, and I remember that. I remember knowing that, particularly for violence. I'm sure some of the drug use played a part, but you know that this movie is so, so crazy violent, and I know some stuff from the chainsaw sequence that I mentioned earlier did have to come out, and I don't believe was restored. Eventually, De Palma snuck a little bit of stuff back in, assuming that nobody would notice, and nobody did, so the movie went out slightly harder edged than perhaps they had originally approved. But by the time I saw the movie, because I didn't see it in 1983, I had already been raised on such a diet of crazy action movies that were super violent. And, you know, at this point in 2015, we've seen The Raid and we've seen The Raid 2, and we've seen stuff that just pushes violence into crazy levels of, like, the most fucked up horror movies. And so I don't bat an eye at Scarface, you know? It's nothing to me, but you forget that in 1983, like, you just did not have movies where this many people are gunned down or cut up with chainsaws or hung from helicopters. I mean, and part of it, again, it goes back to this idea that Quentin Tarantino has talked about with Reservoir Dogs, that Reservoir Dogs is not nearly as violent as people claim it is, or as its reputation would suggest, that actually a lot of the violence takes place off screen. You see the aftermath. It's suggested in a lot of ways. And he says, but that's good. That means I've done my job. And the same is true of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. We remember these movies as being so violent because they're such an uncomfortable, sweaty, violent atmosphere to them. There's an unpleasantness that feels like violence is hanging in the air at all times, right? Yeah. Scarface absolutely does that as well. So as violent as the movie is, and it's super violent, I would argue it actually feels twice as violent just because of the way that the violence just hangs in the air in every single scene.
It's definitely true in the chainsaw scene. That is, I think, my favorite. I think that's my favorite sequence in the movie, I would say, even better than the final gun battle, just because it doesn't feel as theatrical as some of the other stuff. It feel like you use the adjective sweaty, and that's pretty good. I mean, I feel like I'm in that tiny motel room, and I, you know, the sound effect is very effective, the whirring of the chainsaw, and you're right, it's about setting an atmosphere. And I mean, I don't even think that they don't show a breaching of the blade into the skin, but it's a, right? Am I?
No, you don't actually see that, and I don't know exactly what was cut out. I know the scene was more graphic originally, and I honestly can't decide if I like it better without the more graphic shit, or if I just wish, because everything else in the movie just goes for it in such a crazy way that part of me is like, yeah, no, they should have just let him cut people up with chainsaws and shown it. It would have been right at home in this movie. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think the problem is the movie would have never been able to top that.
Yeah, that's true.
And certainly not recover. Certainly not recover from it. Yeah, it's early enough that it would have been a mistake, I think, to keep it in.
All right.
Let's get to Mr. Pacino.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. Terrible performance or great performance?
This is another one that I sort of went back and forth on. Okay,
terrible performance that, like, somehow
I know
becomes great, right?
Well, I mean, you try and figure out, this is where I keep going back to, like, the fine line between, I was kind of asking you this about when we were talking about Maps of the Stars. I was like, where does camp begin and sincerity end? It's like this weird snake eating the tail thing. I think he gives, I feel okay saying that I think he gives a good performance.
Okay.
And I can't even mount a particularly passionate defense of that viewpoint, but I'm going to try. I think, first of all, I just kind of admire the audacity of his performance, right? Like, I mean, it's definitely bold. He makes definitive decisions. There's not a wishy-washy note in here. And I feel as though, I mean, if he's playing a very angry man, and so is it okay that it's kind of a one-note performance colored mostly by fits of rage? I think that's okay. It's definitely the accent is really funny. There's no denying that. It is a hilarious thing to say, to listen to imitate.
Does intent matter? Like,
right, that's what I keep coming back to.
If
yeah,
he didn't intend for that to be funny, is it still funny? If he was like really doing his best studied, researched Cuban character, Cuban accent, is it still great? Because this is the thing I can't quite reconcile as I watch the movie. Like, it's a terrible performance in so many ways, and yet it somehow transcends this crazy movie to the point where, I mean, the performance is pitched to such a degree that he ends up bringing the rest of the movie up to his level or down to his level, however you want to look at it. And the movie already is pitched so crazy, and yet Pacino kind of takes it into this stratosphere. We've talked before on the podcast, I think JB has talked about how The Shining was the movie that kind of ruined Jack Nicholson, that from then on we got variations on crazy Jack doing Jack Torrance, you know. And I've heard some speculate that Scent of a Woman was the film that ruined Al Pacino. I think it might have been Scarface. I don't know.
I'd have to look. I just pulled up his IMDb. I mean, Justice for All was in 1979. Scenery chewing, but not to this level.
Yeah,
this is like literally every. Yeah, I mean, like, and Justice for All has the famous climactic scene where he goes ape shit. But he's permanently going apeshit in Scarface.
Well, so I'm watching this movie, and I'm like, what the fuck is he doing? Why is he doing this? Why did anyone allow it? And again, I think it's because De Palma and Oliver Stone, who was in the throes of a crazy cocaine addiction, as if you couldn't tell watching this movie, like, this is a cocaine movie in every single way. Just let him be completely unleashed. And I think, in one way, it's such a miscalculation, the performance. And in another way, I'm like, nope, that's perfect. That's exactly what it's supposed to be. So I'm so torn because I'm watching and I'm like, this is horrible. And yet, it's like you said, it's ambitious. It swings for the fences. For the longest time, I considered Nicolas Cage to be like my favorite actor. And this was before kind of the late 90s when he started doing all of the action movies. And then now he's just, you know,
well, yeah,
there are no words for just how lazy he has become. But the thing that I liked about him was how fucking crazy he was, that his performances were always super out there. It's the same reason, you know, I love Jennifer Jason Leigh in Hudsucker Proxy or to some extent, even Julianne Moore in Maps of the Stars. You know, I like a performance that takes some big chances. And Nicolas Cage goes into Peggy Sue Got Married, and he's like, well, I'm going to do the voice of Pokey from Gumby and Pokey. Like, that's my character choice. And so he does it, and he gets away with it. And it's insane, and I love it. And he does Vampire's Kiss, and he's doing this insane German expressionistic acting. And that's the reason that that movie even works, is because of his crazy batshit performance. So I can't, and I don't know if I still have the stomach for that. I mean, this is when I was probably, you know, 20 and experiencing different kinds of movies and different kinds of performing styles and stuff like that. So I don't know that me now would look at some of those Nicolas Cage performances and be like, that's great. That's fearless. That's interesting. Having said that, it's not fair for me to hold those up as performances that I like and then look at Pacino and Scarface and say, nope, too big. This doesn't work. Even though I think it's too big and I'm not sure it works.
No,
I cannot decide how I feel about this.
No, you shouldn't. I mean, I'm the person who's like actively defending the Pacino performance here, but I don't think you can be weighed down by this weird binary Nicolas Cage rule you've set up for yourself. But I did want to say one thing. This is weird and not a credit to his acting at all, but it's just funny because many movies, particularly these days, take pains to shoot around this kind of thing. And this is not actually an acting thing. It's, I guess it's more of a filmmaking thing. But his Al Pacino's sort of minuscule stature works so beautifully in this movie.
Agreed.
Tom Cruise is a small guy, and he's been in a million action movies where that is their pains are taken to hide that. But there are lots of wide shots here. Then he just where like it's apparent where he is measuring up to everybody else, and it just plays into his like I don't give a fuck about to like fly off the handle at any moment persona, which is just something I really love. Again, I'm not giving him extra points for being so short, but I'm just saying it all works. Like his physicality is part of his performance, right? Like I mean, and that's
and De Palma, like you said, instead of hiding it and trying to make him seem more menacing. I mean, yeah, you can certainly look at it and be like, yeah, no, he's a pit bull. You know, he's small, but he's gonna fuck you up. But I also think De Palma goes out of his way to dwarf Pacino in the frame. I mean, even when you think about that that shootout at the end. I mean, not only is he kind of very small in the frame as a way of sort of isolating him. Okay, now he's entirely on his own, and it's him versus all these people. But again, it reminds us that like this is a small man in every sense of the word. Physically, emotionally, he is just a petty, small man. And yeah, I the movie never tries to paint him.
I know
as anything but the bad guy, you know. And that's one of my issues with the movie, because I'm saying all these things that I like about it, and this is how I feel about this movie. I'm so conflicted on it. Like, for me, it's kind of mid-range De Palma. I feel about this movie a lot of ways that I feel about Casino. Like, I can watch Casino at any time, but I have so many problems with it. I totally lost the thread. So it's mid-range De Palma, there's all these things. Oh, so one of the things I don't like about it, there's always this argument that movie characters, main characters in particular, have to be likable. They have to be sympathetic, right? And I know, you know, movie studios prefer that you have a main character who is likable and or sympathetic. They're not big on the anti-hero. And if it is an anti-hero, you know, you got to make him cool and brooding. You got to make him Ryan Gosling and Drive, you know?
Yeah.
And while I think Scarface obviously makes the case that you can have a movie that centers on just kind of an unrepentant piece of shit, part of my problem with the movie is that he's not an interesting antihero. He has no real shading. He wants to have sex with his sister. That's maybe his most compelling personality trait. But I don't think he's a very compelling protagonist / antagonist, and that's one of my issues with the movie, is that it's very, very kind of surface level, except for the stuff with the sister, which then gets into some psychology stuff. There's a little bit going on beneath the surface. I couldn't tell you what necessarily, but it's one of the few things that's not just completely face value.
Yeah, I mean, he's just kind of a vessel, right? I mean, he's a vessel for this movie's weird agenda, scatterbrained as it is.
But what is the agenda then?
Oh no, I don't know. I mean, I'm saying it's very muddled and like schizophrenic. I don't know what it is.
I think it's ultimately kind of a takedown. And the fact that it comes out in '83, Reagan had just become president. Again, I don't want to get political, but I mean, the movie seems very, very critical of America, American excess, the costuming, the gaudy fucking interior of his house. There's nothing subtle again about the mountain of cocaine on his desk that he just dives his face to at the end of the film.
Do you think it's like a take? Again, we're veering into stuff that's probably so fucking boring. But do you like? Do you think it's like a take? Like, do you think it's a commentary on how fucked up capitalism is, as well as communism? Just because, like, okay, you came here looking for freedom.
I don't really think it's a takedown of how fucked up communism is. I mean, I think it pays some lip service to that. Pacino saying like it sucks, we all have to do it this way. I think it pays lip service to communism sucking. I think it is 100% a critique of capitalism.
Yeah. And I don't know. And this is whatever, more than 30 years ago now, but I mean, is there anything more tired than just like a like the trope of, oh, the perversion of the American dream.
Right.
Like I, and to your point, like you said before, I mean, it was fairly innovative for its time, but that is a fairly timeless theme.
Well, but in and of itself, it's a remake of a 1932 film, which said the same thing. I mean, that world is yours shit comes right out of the 32 film, so nothing is new about that. It had been some time since I saw the Howard Hawks Scarface.
I wanted to talk about this, yeah.
It's been years since I saw it, and so my memory was like, it's very loose. It's a very loose adaptation. And yet I reread even the plot summary of the Howard Hawks Scarface on Wikipedia before we recorded, right? Because I'm all about doing hardcore research.
Yeah,
Wikipedia summary.
In the books.
And it actually, it follows a very similar progression. It's a lot alike. It's a lot like the Howard Hawks film in terms of some of the major storytelling beats, some of the stuff with the sister, the stuff with the best friend. I mean, all of those things are in that Howard Hawks film. So I don't know why my memory was that it's such a tenuous connection, because they're actually pretty similar. And so if you've got Hawks in 32 doing the world is yours irony because this guy's dead, all the De Palma film does is take that idea and then crank it up to 11, you know?
I was going to ask you actually about what you thought. I haven't seen the 32 movie in probably 5 or 6 years or something, but what you thought for all the problems that we have with Scarface 1983, the movie, and we've sort of unpacked them here. What do you think about it in the, like, under the umbrella of discussing movie remakes? Because I feel like, especially nowadays, we're always sort of grappling with this, right? In this world of reboots and reimaginings and repurposing of known property. I feel like this, it sounds like you disagree because you're saying they follow a fairly parallel track. I feel like this is a pretty good, like, if we have to live in a world where remakes happen, I feel like this is an okay example of it, if only because, like, you can take an entirely different tonal approach.
Oh, no, I agree completely. The fact that I couldn't even remember that it followed it so closely, I think, speaks to that. And you know, I was reading Wikipedia summaries and saying, like, yeah, the major story beats are the same. But they are very different movies, a very different kind of interpretation of, you know, similar material. Obviously, updating it for the time helps. I don't know if, you know, changing him from Cuban or changing him from Italian to Cuban really makes that much of a difference, except it's like Oliver Stone trying to say, well, I want to talk about something that's going on now.
Right now.
Cuba is going on right now. And can you pass me another mountain of cocaine? So, is it necessary to the film? No, not necessarily, but it does at least change it enough. No, I totally agree. If you have to do these remakes, I think this movie stands on its own apart from the original.
Yeah. I don't know. Anything else you want to really hit on?
It's a weird thing because I feel like I could probably talk about it for another hour, and yet I probably don't need to.
This is whenever I try, whenever we get to reach near the end of these things, I'm always like, well, I mean, we didn't alter the historical discussion of Scarface. I don't know. Scarface will live on long after we're dead and gone.
It's another one of these movies that I'm like, it's probably not really great, and yet I know I'm going to watch it like a few more times.
You know? Yeah, I feel like we say that a lot, and it's definitely
especially,
true,
I think, given the Blu-ray and how much I like.
Definitely, yeah. Now I want to revisit
the Blu-ray.
It
yeah.
more than I thought that I would, like, you know, a week before you asked me to do the show.
So. Right. I got to give props to Michelle Pfeiffer also.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Kind of one of her first starring roles, and I really only want to give her credit because she appears to have invented Paris Hilton. not that, like, that's a brand new person, but just the look and just the dead eyes and the constant boredom. At one point, she even, to me, Michelle Pfeiffer has the thesis of the film, which is when Tony is sitting in his hot tub, yet another shot designed to make him very, very small. He's in this oversized hot tub like a baby in a bath, and then De Palma brings the camera way up. Again, it's this idea of, oh, this man is an island, he's isolated, he's alone, no amount of stuff and possessions can, you know, complete him or whatever. But to me, it's just like, haha, look at how small he is. Look at the little baby. Yeah. But she basically says, like, oh my God, will you stop swearing and stop talking about
About money.
Yeah, stop talking about money. It's boring. And I was like, yeah, that's this movie. Like, that's
I was watching with my fiance now, who had never seen it, and she was like, that is how I feel.
That is the movie.
I was like, well, okay.
And so, you know, having a character, giving a character the foresight to, like, sort of speak that, maybe they knew what they were doing, but... Yeah, she did kind of invent the contemporary socialite, the Kim Kardashian and the Paris Hiltons of the world. Pacino would reunite with De Palma 10 years later, 11 years later. I don't remember exactly when. I want to say it was 93 that Carlito's Way came out. It's astounding to me, by the way, that these movies are only 10 years apart, because they feel at least 20.
Miles apart, yeah.
Do you like that performance better?
Love Carlito's Way, although he does... Well, if we're going to talk about annoying character tics, if his volume is the problem in Scarface, doesn't he have that weird lisp in Carlito's Way?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something... But that's a nitpick, I guess, in the I also love that performance because that feels like a human being. Like I was saying before... I haven't seen Carlito's Way in a long time, but I found it to be a much more interesting meditation on crime and sort of the consequences of pursuing a life of crime, as opposed to just the obvious worldview of Scarface, where, like, oh, if you pursue a life of crime too long and too aggressively, you're going to end up dead. I should revisit Carlito's Way. I remember liking it a lot. I haven't seen it recently enough to, like, engage you in an in-depth discussion, but I do like it a lot.
I like it too. I haven't seen it in maybe 2 years, and it's not a De Palma movie that I return to all the time. It's interesting at the time that it was very much marketed as, like, Pacino's reuniting with De Palma for another gangster movie. It's like when they made Casino after Goodfellas, you know? It's
right.
Like, where the Scarface team is back. And yet the movies are so different.
Very different.
And Carlito's Way does a lot of the things that I'm criticizing Scarface for not doing, including De Palma's kind of show-offy visual stuff, because he does a lot of it in Carlito's Way, and it's a much more human story and a much more kind of subtle story, like you were saying. And yet, if placed side by side, like... It would depend on my mood which one I would feel like watching. Sure. It's not like, oh, I would go to Carlito's Way every time. Because there would definitely be days where I would be like, nah, I'm going to watch Scarface again.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't get it.
Which speaks to, he casts a wide net of stuff that you might want to watch, you know, depending on how you're feeling.
I guess. Last question. Scarface or Snake Eyes?
Oh, I am an unapologetic defender of Snake Eyes.
I know you are. That's why.
Without a doubt. I don't even have to think about it for that long. God, I need to revisit it too. It's been too
long. Snake Eyes is like as bad or worse a movie than Scarface, right? But we can at least admit that. I like Snake Eyes, right? But like we have to acknowledge it's not a good movie.
I'll concede that. However, it does address one of your concerns about not being quite De Palma.
Oh, well,
enough.
That's why that whole movie exists. I mean,
yeah, no, I know. Well, that's, I mean, it's like, I mean, to,
that's
to
all it has going. It has that and Nicolas Cage, those, and Carlo Gugino, because any movie with Carlo Gugino is better than a movie without Carlo Gugino. Without those things, there's no movie there.
I mean, you're like freebasing De Palma when you watch Snake Eyes, which is why. And I'm not even to continue with this drug metaphor that's gone out of control again. Not a I'm a junkie like you are, but I love that movie unapologetically. Probably gonna pop it in now.
Nice, right on.
Yeah,
I don't think that's been released on Blu-ray yet, and somebody needs to take care of that, because
yes, definitely.
I so wish the third act of that movie was better. I think that movie might actually be really good if it had any third act whatsoever.
Yeah, I don't even really remember what happens, and I guess that's kind of the point, and sort of like says all we need to say about some guys. But yeah.
Anyway, thank you guys for listening. Thank you to Booster Gold for recommending this movie for a podcast. Remember, if you have a show or a movie that you'd like us to try to do a show on, we can't promise that we'll get to it, but we will sure try. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Alex, for talking Scarface with me.
Thank you.
We will see you guys next week. Alex, you want to take us out?
Yeah, I mean, Scarface was just this big movie waiting to get fucked, and I think we did it.